Like us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castillo. Back in the studio today, we used to be able to have him on at least once a year. However, he's been gone for a little bit longer this time, so it has been a little bit longer than that. He is a hometown, home-produced artist. He's a playwright, a director, an actor. Cody Daigle, he is currently directing the summer programs, the summer youth programs in theater at the Delta Grand in Opelousas, and he is currently still functions as a company playwright with Manhattan Theater Works, Manhattan Theater Company, which has produced some of his original pieces and continues to stay involved, too, with some theater companies and schools out of the Omaha, Nebraska area and Tulsa, Oklahoma. Cody has had a number of pieces that have been done off Broadway, and some of those have toured different parts of the United States, which has been a great thing. It's been fun to watch his business is what it is. I mean, seriously, right, Cody?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a business.
Yeah. Very much so.
Which people forget.
So. Yes.
It's been fun to watch your business grow.
And it's been fun to have it happen that way.
Yeah. So welcome back.
Thanks. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big message to continue. You know, we talk about that a lot on this show and in the area here, because there are so many talented artists in all kinds of realms here in the area, but that it is a business. And when you look at where you started and the work that you produce, the original work that you produce in your plays and your writings, that for you is your business.
Well, and yeah, I think when you're – as a college student, you sort of imagine – I sort of imagine that success in this industry would mean my show is on Broadway and I am a Tony – nominee or so that, like, that's the way that you achieve success or perceive it. And it's been a great lesson to learn that you can be a very successful playwright, getting produced in places and schools and working in companies that are not New York and other places, and still be able to make money doing
that's
this
right.
job. And so you can be the busiest playwright nobody's ever heard of, and still you live your life as a playwright, which is a nice thing to learn.
That's right. You know, one thing I wanted to talk about, because there's a lot to focus on with some of the other companies and out of state that you have been involved with, but your career took a bit of a detour for a while when you were in the Philadelphia area.
Yes.
And you worked with a company. Can you tell us about the company and the job that you did while you were there?
Yeah, when I was in Philly, I worked in the for-profit side of the arts
yeah.
world. I worked for a management company called Balin Arts Artist Management, and we represented touring artists in music, theater, dance, and children's and family theater, basically. So we would book tours into venues around the country, and we would send folks around. Like if you saw Pasa's Danu Christmas concert, that was one of our artists, and we booked those shows. Artists like that.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I worked as an artist representative.
So I'm curious, what did you learn? Two things about yourself as an artist from working in that. You know, what did it change? What it did add? What it maybe. Mm-hmm. made you take a step back, and, you know, things that you just learned about the arts world in general from working for that company. I mean, because that's a whole different thing than what you had done.
It's very different. And what I learned about myself is that I really wasn't terrifically suited for it. Working on that end of the equation, not being the artist end, but working on the management end and that business end, it really is very much – just a business. You really aren't there. There isn't so much of a creative aspect in it, and which was a challenge for me, and it wasn't particularly well suited for it. But it really opens up your eyes to what's possible. I mean, there are artists and theater companies touring all around the country all year long, making a really great living doing the work that they love to do. Small touring companies, like a small theater. We had a Mad Theater, Mad River Theater Works, and they did.
And were they out of the Philadelphia area?
They were out of Ohio.
Okay.
But they would do American history-based plays or sort of American folklore-based plays, yeah. Small company, small set requirements, some music. And we would book tours for them, like a two-month tour at a time, and they would go, this small company out of Ohio, and they would do theater professionally for the time that they were out, make great money for their company. When they weren't on the road, they'd be creating new pieces or working things in their rep to tour again. And that was how they made their living. And that's and it's inspiring, and it makes you hopeful that in some situation you can still have a life in the arts that maybe just doesn't look like what we think it looks like.
Yeah.
Or what we are taught that it looks like.
Sure. Because I think sometimes – and this is – I'll speak for myself is that you think of touring theater acts. I don't know. I guess I think of already at the Broadway level. Mm-hmm. And then I think of the local, meaning state local theater companies who might do some things within their state. I don't always think about that other level of what you just talked about, mm-hmm. that you don't have to be this already kind of Broadway recognized piece to go tour the country.
And particularly in educational theater,
yeah.
Theater that's whose purpose is to educate to some degree or to create experiences in the arts for young people, that is a great market to create things and tour things. Schools and universities, community centers are always looking for these sorts of things to bring to their constituents and to their audience or patronage. So there are tons of that all over the place.
And did you get a sense while you were working there about, companies like that? There's a lot of them.
You know, every year there's a big conference in New York called APAP, where presenters and artists from all – and touring companies from all
That's
over
a lot
the
of
country.
Festivals and places
right,
to go to.
Right.
Okay.
And so you go to this conference and it's in this giant hotel in downtown Manhattan. It's a three-floor experience covered with presenters. And in every booth is someone – who's either looking for a show or have artists who are there representing. And we're talking about thousands of touring artists in all the disciplines who are actively touring the country, making work and getting paid for it, which is it's inspiring. It's not just the 20 or so theaters on Broadway that where people's plays are being done. You have
sure.
this whole network of theaters and things nationally where you can work.
Were there set things that you noticed being involved in that side of the companies or individuals even that were chosen or hired, that they did maybe just a little bit different than other people to get themselves noticed?
Unfortunately, it's the cynical part of the business. The most successful things are either things that are affordable that you can bring in on small budgets because
okay.
most presenters in parts of the country that are not incredibly well-funded, they just don't have a lot of money to
yeah.
bring something in. Things that are small, things that are name recognized do very well, things that they can really count on getting an audience and selling tickets for. Those are the kinds of things that do very well. Theater for young audiences sells because generally family shows, there's a way to – you can sell that in your community.
You get a lot of people in the
seats.
Yeah,
you can get a lot of people in the seats for a family show.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of just sort of mid-size or small independent theaters who are touring adult shows like
yeah.
Adult plays. Because that's a harder sell and it's harder to make that investment.
Which is – I guess, you see more of that regional mindset of working together where different theaters or, performing arts centers will tap in to other performing arts centers or theaters within the area to bring the same folks
right.
down. I mean,
yeah.
that cuts down on the –
Yeah, and they're very good about that. I worked with presenters in the Midwest, and so we would try to connect presenters who are nearby each other, who are all interested in the same sort of artist, who could maybe send them through this one place, and they can all get it more affordably, so they can bring something to their audiences that they really want with less of a financial risk involved for them.
What a good experience for you, though.
Yeah, it was really eye-opening.
To learn that. Yeah, that's right. And I think, too, to really stress the importance, you know, which we do always in the arts, and that's a part that a lot of artists struggle with, is that whole business side of it, because like it or not, it's there. And it's the reality of the situation. And either you learn how to do it in a way that's workable for you and that you're okay at, or you get some help with
it.
You get somebody to do it for you.
It's really challenging. And I'm still, as a playwright, I'm still improving and learning how to be a better representative for myself, because I am not a playwright yet who is at the place where he can have an agent or who has an agent.
Sure.
If there's an agent, I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
But so I have to be the one who sends the plays out and represents myself and promotes my shows. And, it's a tough business to do. And I'm still learning how to do that this many years into writing plays and having them produced.
So what have you learned recently about how to do that? About some things that work, or at least work for you.
Well, really, I really just need to get better about submitting. My submission diligence is on the low side, so I need to be better about that. I have been very lucky that I have standing relationships with companies and people who produce shows, so that I have projects lined up. So I finish a play, it gets produced, I'm writing the next one, so I'm not really so much
okay, but I'm going to back up on
that.
I think that is – we've talked about this with somebody else on here before. It's so much more than about being lucky. You know, you had to work hard to develop those relationships, you know, and it may be fortunate now that I have worked hard to make those relationships. But, you know, if you would have been a pain in the rear to work with, the luck wouldn't have been there. No, do you know what
I mean? Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel very grateful. I feel I have, because not everybody has that. I have like three or four.
And you've worked hard though.
Three or four companies that I can send something to and go, hey, would you maybe consider producing this, or let's develop a show? That doesn't happen a lot for a lot of writers.
Yeah.
So I have been bad about submitting, just simply because I'm always one project finishes and I'm writing the next play instead of focusing on that one and sending it out to its other places so that they can have longer lives than just the one production or the workshop or the reading that I'm writing it for. So
yeah.
I have to get better at that.
Your the focus of your work now and how you are producing, has that changed at all in the last couple years?
Like the writing itself?
Mm-hmm.
A lot, actually. In the last two, I'm writing a lot faster and a lot more instinctively than I ever have before. I begin plays now not necessarily knowing what I'm getting into so much. I'll have like a general idea, but I'll just begin a show and dive in and trust that it's going to go someplace. The shows are getting shorter.
Are you typing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't read it anymore.
Yeah.
It's terrible. I have no idea what I've written.
Yeah.
They're shorter. I've been writing a lot of intermissionless shows. So a play now is – a full-length play for me really feels more like 75 to 90 minutes instead of two-hour-long acts divided by intermission.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're getting shorter and more compact, and that's just sort of been a natural evolution, I guess. But the writing – it's not so labored. I write a lot faster and I write more now than I've ever written before.
Do you think that's about experience, or, you know, the time that you've put in, or what has added to your ability to be able to do that quicker?
Maybe part of it is just you practice a skill enough and it just becomes easier to do. But I also think, I mean, I'm 38 now and I pretty much know myself in as much as I possibly can at 38, the way I didn't when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
So now it's very easy to access those parts of myself that I need to get to write. So I can just sit down and I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable telling the truth. I don't second guess myself. I don't have the doubting voice in my head going, your play is terrible. This is a terrible scene. Don't write that.
That's a bit.
You should write this. I just, if the play wants to go to some weird place, then that's where we go. And I hope for the best once it's done, which is great. It's a great place to be.
And then find where that fits in terms of being produced.
And I just think that's because now I'm older.
Yeah, yeah. You know, with the work that you're doing now and the work that you've done with some of the other companies around, are they asking for – are they commissioning work from you?
Yes. That's generally how most of the new stuff I've written lately has come about. There's only
– Do they lay down stipulations?
No, not really. Hey, we like something. Let's work on something.
Okay.
Or I'll be told – Acadiana Repertory Theater, who's doing The Survivalists, Steven approached me and said, hey, listen, we would love to do a show of yours.
And that's a local company.
That's a local company. Exactly. So we'd love to do a show next season. What do you think? And I said, this play, I'd like to write that. Okay, fine. And that was the play. There were no questions or stipulations about what it should be. I just wrote the play that I wanted to write, and they are producing it.
Yeah.
So,
and that one actually is going to be done this July.
Yes.
The Survivalists.
Yes, The Survivalists.
And that's going to be at Theater
810. Theater
810. Tell us about that production.
Sure. The Survivalist is a play about a guy named Ben who is fresh out of rehab for the second time. His partner has broken up with him and asked him to move out of their apartment. And he's found out he has kidney cancer and has to have his kidney removed. He has no place else to turn except to his sister, Annie, who he has a strained relationship with. She and her husband have lost a child in the last year. The child had a brain tumor and that child, Katie, died. And so they're going through a grief of their own. And Ben is wrapped up in that grief in a way that – I don't want to spoil anything in the play, but he's wrapped up in that grief. And so they all have to live together in this time where Ben is trying to navigate his way through cancer. And so it's this family play essentially about coming to terms with the conditions of your life and finding a way to be happy about them, finding a way to at least find peace with the conditions of your life even though they're not what you want them to be. And so that's kind of the nut of the play.
Now, you're a cancer survivor.
Yes. I had kidney cancer.
So you went within yourself to find
– Yeah. I wanted – since it happened, this is now about 4 years. I'm 4 years out.
4 years out?
In October, it'll be 4 years out.
Okay.
I wanted – since that experience, I wanted to write something that would explore what I got out of that experience or what that experience felt like or meant to me. And I never just wanted to write, oh, here's a play. Here's my cancer play. This was my cancer story because I just think that's been done. People have told those stories. I wanted to find some other way to do it. And this became the way – the construct in which to do it. So it wasn't just a play about someone having cancer. It was this – family play about the challenges of sort of facing difficulty in your life and finding a way to come to peace with the conditions of your life, no matter what they are. And so that, yeah, I wrote from that.
So I'm curious, when you were going through, you know, your own treatment with cancer, was writing there for you at that time?
No. It was an experience that I felt I wasn't going to write about. It was
and not necessarily, I guess, writing about the cancer, but just writing, period. Was that any kind of solace for you during that time that you would pick up or pick up your laptop? And
no, life felt too much to do that. It felt too much to do that. It all had to be about what was actually happening in my life and sort of paying attention to it. I was very aware during that time of feeling like I hadn't written everything I wanted to write, that if this story had a negative ending, I would be leaving my life not having done everything I wanted to do as a writer. That was a very present thing. But to write during that time would have been – it'd have been bad. That would have not been. And the plays would have been just miserable and depressing.
Yeah, but I mean, and it's not. I was just curious, you know, that if that helped you at all during that time, or if that just, like you said, though, you set it aside.
Yeah, and for a long time, I felt that experience, I couldn't write about it. That it was almost too personal.
Yeah.
To really write about what the core of that was, until I found a way to do it and not soil the the personal stuff that I didn't really want to write about.
Sure. Has that been cast yet?
Yes, they've been in rehearsal for
that's
a while.
Okay.
It's a really good cast. Yes. Stephen Landry, Etiana Wright. And I wrote the role that she plays, I wrote it for her. She gets to do one show a year because of her kids. And she's like, I want to do your show. So I was like, all right, I'll write something for you since you're going to take the time to do it. So that role is written for her. Alan Higginbotham, who's done some shows here and also in Eunice. Jack Robertson is in the play. And
Jack just finished up the one at Cite too.
Yeah.
He was in that one. Okay.
And is that everybody?
Four
people? That's everybody. Yeah. And there's
are you directing?
No, Debbie Ardoin is directing.
Oh, Debbie from Eunice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I have only popped into rehearsal twice, and I'm going to see the show when it opens, I think.
Now, has that changed for you, or was that ever where you needed to be more hands-on, or have you always been able to step back when it's a piece of yours that other people are taking?
Depends on the show. With this show, I had the benefit Stephen and Acadiana Rep gave me a week of workshopping with the actors in the cast. So we sat around a table and we read the show and worked on it, and I did some rewrites. So when they went into like real rehearsal, I had written the show that I wanted to write and I felt really good about it. It sounded good. I was happy with it. Great. So I feel good about not being in rehearsal because what am I going to do? I'm just going to sort of sit there and nod and go, oh, yes, that's lovely.
Yeah.
I sort of want to wait and experience the show the way an audience would and be surprised by the choices that they've made and that they've discovered. I trust them, so I don't feel I don't feel like I need to be there.
Yeah.
If I think the play's in trouble, I want to be in rehearsal. If I don't trust the people making it, I want to be in rehearsal. A lot. But I trust these guys, and they did In the Bones last year, and it was really good. So I trust them, and they're going to do a good job with it.
You know, I think the other thing, too, when I think about you and that whole trust factor with that, I mean, you've had some pretty significant experience now with some of your pieces, your original pieces, being done at a distance, quite a distance from where you've been living.
That happens a lot.
Yeah. So, and you really, that really takes that away.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have the opportunity to.
When MT Works did A Home Across the Ocean in New York.
And that's who's now called the Manhattan Theater.
Yes, that's now Manhattan Theater Works. When they did A Home Across the Ocean, the first, we got a couple of negative reviews and I was really bummed out by it. And David Stallings, who's the artistic director, we were having coffee or something, and he said, you know, really at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what anybody thinks of your play. If you sit and watch it and it does what you wanted it to do, nothing else really matters. And that was kind of like one of those lightning bolt shifts about shifts in how I kind of deal with my work. I'm happy to give my work over to anybody who I trust to do what they want to do with it, and they can have their own journey with the play. As long as I know that I've done what I wanted to do with it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. I always want to try to make it better for an audience or cleaner or tighter. But if you don't like it, that's okay. If it does what I wanted to do, then the work was worth doing. And that's that.
Yeah, exactly. Is a lot of what's coming out of you now, is it a set kind of age group audience do you think that the writings are for? Or are there young people's? You know, like teenager children ideas coming out.
No, everybody's getting older and much more conflicted.
They are. that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I found that I keep writing plays that I hesitate to describe as anything because they're never one set. Survivalists is – although it has a very bleak setup, like the setup I described sounds like – the most depressing thing you could ever see. It's actually a comedy. It's actually funny.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm kind of working in that place where everything is a gray area. It's everyone is having conflicted feelings about where they are in the world and how to get to the next place. And
yeah, a lot of your – I don't think I'm off on this, but I think a lot of your pieces really focus on the human reactions to, you know, to one another and relationships and how they're formed and how we work with this person and work with that person.
That's what I'm most interested in watching.
Okay.
I never really think I'm very good when I'm writing about ideas or writing something political or if I have something to say in
quotes.
Yeah,
yeah.
I don't think I'm at my best as a writer there. Writing scenes where people are being kind of messy and human, that is exciting to me to watch, and that's exciting to write.
Yeah. Cody, and I'm spacing this out right now. What was the play? They were on the airplane and
Providence.
Providence.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the, and I don't mean to say, you know, powerful, and here I'm forgetting the name of it, but I mean, it truly was, you know, in terms of human interaction and how we react to one another and, you know, just what goes on within us.
Yeah.
You know, individually. That was an incredibly powerful piece.
I still love that play.
Yeah.
I'll pull it out every once in a while. Because 2007 was the first time it was written.
It's
been around for a while. And I'll still read it and still find things in it that I'm incredibly proud of as a whole.
Has there ever been one that you've wanted to go back and redo?
The one show that I would love to fix is Guernica. My first play. I would love to. I don't think I can. I don't think it's fixable. I think it's one of those plays that it was a really big idea for someone who was very young and didn't know what he was doing.
You did that when you were in school.
Yeah, I was 18.
Here
at UL. Yeah, UL produced it my sophomore year of college.
Okay.
And it was the first production I ever had. And it's a deeply, deeply flawed play. And I would love to find a way to fix it so that it could live along with the other ones, but I don't think it's possible. That 18-year-old kid kind of – it's just his play. I'll let it stay his play.
Yeah.
But I would love to – I wish I could fix it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break. You brought in some music, and it's all the Hot Club of San Francisco.
Yeah.
What role is that playing in your life right now with your professional, your writing, with –
Yeah, so now I'm in a very bountiful place where I'm generally working on more than one play at a time for whatever purpose.
It's a good term to use, a bountiful.
It's place. A bountiful because I was going to say lucky, but
yeah, that's good. Bountiful.
Learning.
Okay.
So we're in a very bountiful place where I'm working on multiple projects at once, and to help me get into the emotional or internal space for each play, I'll have little playlists to sort of, I'll sit down and I'll get into the space. The music helps me get into the space of a play so that I can shoo the other things away and focus on this world and what this play should feel like. And so Hot Club is the survivalist that album, Postcards from Gypsy Land, was the album that would get me into that world.
How'd you find out about this group?
We represented them when I worked at Balin.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've got that whole personal connection
yeah.
with them too. Well, should we listen to – should we just go with track 4?
Yeah.
The waltz – okay. This is Hot Club of San Francisco, and this is Waltz Una Noche. Thank you. That was the Hot Club of San Francisco, brought in by my guest today, Cody Daigle. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. We are a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. We broadcast out of this around the whole Acadiana area into the Lake Charles area. Tip of the hat to everybody who continues to help support what we do here at the station and all the locally national and international produced programs that we have, because it does cost money to do that. So hats off to everybody who continues to help us. And you can do that at any time by going to the website. There's a great donate button. Just click on that. And it's a safe, secure site. Or you can always contact the folks here at KRVS, too. My guest in the studio today really gotten to be known as a playwright. But for a long time in this area, too, people really knew as a director. And acting. I know folks wanted to see him do some more acting, but he really got into some of the other roles. And his playwriting has become very successful for what he is doing now in the arts world. Cody Daigle is I want to talk about, because you've been spending a lot of time with theater companies throughout in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and in the Omaha, Nebraska area. You've also had theater produced up in the Northeast.
Yes.
And I'm curious, when we think of the arts, a lot of times different music, visual art can be influenced by the region that they're mm-hmm. in, by the taste and the color of things in the area, what the culture is in the area. And I'm curious if that happens for theater, if you have seen a difference now in the type of theater or the stories or how new theater is created.
Absolutely. I mean, every theater city has its own sort of distinct DNA, and and they're all very, each theater city has its own sort of feel and vibe and the kind of things that are going to get produced there, or even just their approach to new work particularly, which is generally my interest in another theater community, is what they're doing in terms of new work. But in every city I've been in, the feeling is different, and you get a sense of what might be possible with these particular personalities in this community that supports that.
And so what do you see in the differences with new work? You know, with how you – and maybe does it change how you approach what you're going to give to a specific company in a specific part of the United States?
Well, new work is really hard to do anywhere, really, because theater audiences unless you're in a theater city like Chicago or a big theater city where there's a theater culture that has a consistent track record of going to the theater and people are in the habit of doing it, it's hard to take a chance on a new play because nobody knows this play to spend the money and make that the effort to go to the theater. It's harder. But, a city like Omaha, Nebraska, which you really wouldn't think of necessarily as
a big university town, though, too.
But you wouldn't really think it was like a hotbed of new plays.
Yeah.
The Great Plains Theater Conference happens there every year, and there are like 30 playwrights from all over the country who come. It's a week-long conference devoted to new play readings.
And is that a juried process, or
yes,
how is that?
Yeah, okay. The plays are selected through a blind submission process. This year, they had 600, over 600
wow.
plays submitted, and then like 30, 35, I think, was the total number, were brought to the festival. They bring in artists from all over the country to respond and to perform and to make work. And then the theater companies around Omaha continue to produce new plays. I saw a new play that was produced by one of the small theater companies, a 50-seat theater, no bigger than Theater 810, producing a brand new play that now has had a sold-out weekend, I think. I mean, they've been selling out shows during their run there. And it's kind of amazing. You know, there's this very broad support for new plays there.
Well, and you know what's great too is when you can get to a point where you have I don't know if you refer to that as a festival, like mm-hmm. a New Works Festival or something, you know, that it's all about educating, you know, the mm-hmm. public,
yes.
really about what theater
yes.
is. Because I think that's a big part of it, is that educational process that has to happen with the general public.
Yeah, and the people in a community, in communities like ours, I grew up here, and so I kind of grew up in this community. But going to see a brand new play or going to the theater in general is not necessarily a common weekend Mm-mm. plan. You sort of have to train people to take a chance on that and to train people to make that part of their entertainment options. It makes it hard for theater companies, though, because while we're working on very small budgets, it's hard to make a sort of experience that's spectacular enough to compete with a Broadway touring musical
sure.
that comes to the Hyman. It's hard for us to compete against the standard options. So, yeah, it's – you do have to educate the audience. That's the whole – it's hard to do. It's kind of a challenge to do, but that's kind of the key, I guess,
yeah,
for new work.
And you know, even for – already published work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's difficult sometimes. I think it's gotten a lot better in this area.
Yeah.
But for Newark especially, you have been gone from here for a period of time,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of coming. You were back last summer for a period. Do you see kind of an evolution in terms of theater in the Acadiana area? And maybe the Lafayette area?
I don't know. I feel very disconnected from it because I sort of see what my friends are up to via Facebook and those sorts of things. I kind of know what they're working on. But, you know, I come home and I have the set things that I'm working on, and that kind of becomes my world for the time that I'm here. I don't necessarily feel what the whole community is like because I'm not really a part of it anymore so much.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a pop-in person now and again to do some stuff.
You know, it was interesting because when Judith was in here talking with us before the show, I think one of the things she mentioned that was real important was, you know, a real strong young presence in theater, mm-hmm. you know, here, which I think it's always been here, but sometimes it's been stronger,
yeah.
you know, than other times. And I think that's – don't you believe that that's real important? You get those
– It's great to hear that because I think every – my whole experience in the arts, while there are practiced older folks – I don't say older folks because I would be one of them too.
Yeah.
But you know, the people who have done theater for a long time, veteran performers and veteran theater makers here make up a lot of the work here. There is something always consistently exciting about what young people get to do here. Lafayette was a great place to kind of grow up as an artist because there are so few expectations about what the theater experience should be. There are so few limitations on what you can do because people, you know, we're not dropping giant amounts of money, tens of thousands of dollars into shows. So we can take some risks because we're not, you know, this is something we all do in our spare time
sure.
as well. So young people with some energy and excitement and ambition have always created really amazing things. And I think they are. I mean, the Tea Sippers are making really interesting choices, and they're all, my gosh, they're all high school students or mm-hmm. are out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's always been the case. Lafayette's a good breeding ground for that.
And that there are venues that have allowed and continue to allow people mm-hmm. to experiment.
Yes, yes.
You know.
I know Sate uses the word incubator, which I think is a really terrific word, an incubator
uh-huh.
for artists. And Theater A10 is very eager to support anybody who wants to come in and put on a show and take some chances. And that's a great thing. You have the ambition, the time, and the opportunity, which great things happen that way.
Exactly. You're working on currently working on a new piece in Omaha?
Yes. Well, for Oklahoma, in Tulsa.
Oh, in Oklahoma. Okay.
Yeah, for one of the high schools, Union High Schools.
Now, you taught. I mean,
mm-hmm.
taught school there, too.
I was a sub all of last year.
Okay.
So I subbed for my friend Jess, who was having a baby.
Okay.
So I subbed her theater class for the fall. And then in the spring, I sort of randomly subbed around. I did some work in special ed and in the regular middle school classroom and those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Jess Branston at Union High School, I write a show for her every year. We've been doing this for 4 years now. And I write an original show for her every year. And she's come up with this completely crazy idea we're going to do a two-part Sherlock Holmes play. So part one will be the fall play and part two will be in the spring. And it features a female Sherlock Holmes.
Wow.
Because
why not?
Why not? And so I finished the first part and I've sent that off
to her. Is the name?
Elementary Ms. Holmes is the name of the play.
Yeah.
So, and it'll be a two-part show. I'll write the second part in the next few months and get that to them, and they'll start that in January.
Are you able to work to get over there to work with the students on that whole process of creating new work?
I probably won't this year. I was able to last year. We did Frankenstein last year, and I was able to be there to direct and help.
As a rewrite, as an adaptation of Frankenstein?
Yes, we did it. We did an adaptation, a 90-minute adaptation of Frankenstein last year, and I was able to work on the show with them.
Was it a musical?
No. It's hard enough to do just the straight adaptation in the musical. I'm no Mel Brooks. But yeah, and so I got to work with them. I probably won't get to work on these shows. I'll try to get out to see it. But it's a wonderful relationship to work with them. I love writing. I love the process of figuring out what we're going to do. And Jess is a terrific director. Her kids are super talented.
Yeah.
So it's always a great joy.
So are there new pieces that you're working on?
The one that's kind of brewing in my head right now is my favorite title. 17 Attempts to Kill Hitler is the I was in Omaha for the Great Plains Theater Conference, and the director of my reading there is Hitler obsessed, and she's like, "Did you know there were 17 failed attempts to kill Hitler, like actual attempts, not just plots?" And I said, "No, I didn't know that." And they're weird too. These weird random occurrences that kept Hitler alive through all these assassination attempts. So I was like, that's a play. There's a play within that somewhere. So I have been thinking a lot about Hitler.
So do you read up like historical things?
Yeah, I've been reading about the different attempts and how they failed. Some of them are so bizarre. The first one that I read, there was a bomb placed in a column near where he was speaking, and it was supposed to go off at the end of his speech because it was timed and everything. And he just randomly cut the speech off 10 minutes before, left, and missed getting blown up. And they're all like – all these attempts are like that. Like, so somebody was watching to keep Hitler around for as long as possible with all these attempts. So it's kind of zany and –
So is it a comedy?
Interesting. I don't know.
You don't know
I don't know yet. I don't know yet.
And that's when you'll submit to – you don't know where you're going to submit it yet.
I don't know where it'll go.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know who would want to do that, but maybe AUI will do that. Marie likes the idea.
Yeah.
Marie Diaz likes the idea. So.
Yeah. You know, when you just mentioned AUI, I think that's something – There continues to be – I'm going to go back for a minute to this area. There continues to be a pretty strong core group of individual theater groups, you know, here. And new ones continue to form. And, you know, I just think like with Brady McKellar and Elsa Dimitriadis, you know, they came in and there's another group, you know.
And what I think is lovely about theater communities and Lafayette is doing that. While there are new theater groups every day and there are more of them, everyone's doing their own sort of thing. Everyone has a niche that they fill or something that they do particularly well. And an audience member in this town can really see a lot of diverse, interesting, ambitious, cool work by just popping around to all the companies and sort of keeping your eye out on what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, AUI has its own thing. Wanderlust is doing its own very interesting thing as well. The longstanding community theaters are all doing great work and interesting things in their own right. It's for a small community, it's very diverse, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. As is your interest in music. I know we had a couple more. We're going to go out on one, but this one we're going to listen to. It's again by the Hot Club of San Francisco. And let's see. This is Aye Parece con una Verde Milonga. That's the best I can do.
I think you did
on
great.
That one. This is the Hot Club of San Francisco.
Thank you.
All right. That was the Hot Club of San Francisco, which these cuts were brought in by my guest today, playwright Cody Daigle. Beautiful.
Yeah, I love this album. Yeah. It's great. It's called Postcards from Gypsyland.
It was music that was inspirational as you were working on The Survivalists?
Yeah. It's that those songs sound like what the play feels like to me.
Yeah.
And so it would help me get to that space.
And again, I just want to remind people that opens up July 10th. That's going to be at Theater 810, and that's being put on by the Cadena Repertory Theater, mm-hmm. Stephen Landry and his group with that. That's fabulous. This summer you are spending quite a bit of time with young people.
Yes.
Teaching them about theater. At the Delta Grand. That's a beautiful space in Opelousas.
Yes.
You have this weekend, you're opening up with Anne of Green Gables.
Yeah, it's an adaptation that I wrote a couple years ago for my friend Jess. It was the first show we worked on.
Ah, okay.
So I adapted it, and I've
so when does that? What does that mean exactly?
So I took the novel and I sat with the novel and turned it into a doable script. So I wrote the stage version of the show.
So there hasn't been a stage.
There have been, but she didn't like any of them. Courtney Sanders, who runs Tulsa, the Playhouse Tulsa, we were all working on a show together, and she said, well, get Cody to do it. And so I was like, yeah, that sounds like fun. I've never read that book. And so I adapted it for her. So I wrote it to sort of fit her student needs.
But you know what I'm asking? Mm-hmm. Like there isn't – there has there been other adapted works of – Anne of Green Gables?
Yes, yeah. And she just read them and didn't like them. She didn't think they
– You're talking about the woman in
– Yeah, that Jess. Yeah. Oh, no.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so she wanted something that was felt a little more contemporary in the way that it moved. And
got it.
She wanted something that was fresher, and so we created one. And now these kids are doing it, and they're doing a lovely job. I cut it down some. And, we're having fun out there.
How large is the class?
It's 15 to 20, somewhere in there. It's a big little group. It's a nice group of kids. They've been doing really great work. It's the first time their youth company has done a two-act show.
This
is the first full-length show.
Yeah.
So they've handled this well. We've put it all together in 3 weeks.
And do the young folks, do they work on set and set design, anything?
A little bit. We try to handle all that tech stuff around them as they have the large challenge of just learning the show and focusing on that. But we have a costumer who's come in, built a lot of costumes for the show and the sets up. And it's a full production of the show.
It's
a lot of fun.
Fabulous. And I know people can go to Delta Grand Theater, and that's theatre, mm-hmm. .com.
Yeah, for tickets.
To find out about the times and for tickets and all of that. Well, and then you have a younger group there too.
Yes. The younger ones come and we're going to do Peter Pan, which I'm working on that. I'm working on a script specifically for us to work on Peter Pan, and we'll do that in July.
In July,
end of July.
And that's a daily program that they come to?
Yeah, 9 to 4, Monday through Friday. They come for 3 weeks, and in 3 weeks we audition, cast, rehearse, design, build, and do the show.
Yeah.
It's a lot. it's great. I'm having the most fun working with these kids. They're bright and they're talented. They're adorable. It's fun. It's a great, great time.
Well, again, just to let people know that Anne of Green Gables is opening this weekend at the Delta Grand in Opelousas, downtown historic Opelousas. Then in July you'll be doing Peter Pan with the younger group out of there. And also July 10th, your original piece, The Survivalists, will be being produced and done at Theater 810 with the Acadiana Repertory Theater. And to find out about that play, I know Theater 810 is on Facebook.
Yes, and so is Acadiana Repertory Theater. You can find information about the show and tickets there.
All right, fantastic. Well, Cody, it'll be interesting to see where your life goes in the next year.
I can't wait to find out either.
And it's great. I'm just going to mention, you can't see this, but he does have a new piece of artwork on his body, and it is a quote from Ray Bradbury.
Ray Bradbury from The Illustrated
that
Man.
It says, write so as not to be dead.
Yeah.
So everybody live by that, no matter what your passion or your art is. We're going to go out again with another song from the Hot Club of San Francisco, from their CD.
Postcards from Gypsyland.
All right. And this is Not So Fast. Have a good week, everybody.
Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit under the daily news shows. This American Life.
Coming up at its new time, Wednesday night at 7.
I'm Poppy Tooker, host of Louisiana Eats. Tune in Saturday afternoons at 4 p.m. for your weekly serving on KRVS 88.7 FM, listener-supported public radio for Acadiana.
KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.